You're listening to Straight Shooters, a straightforward golf podcast that'll straighten out your game. And here are your hosts, Keith Bennett and Henry Stettina.
Welcome back to the Straight Shooters Golf Podcast. I'm Henry Stettina, and I'm alongside Keith Bennett. Keith, tell us about how you're doing and what's going on in your life.
Yeah, man. Just been traveling a little bit here lately. Was on the road, obviously went to the convention there, the Teaching and Coaching Summit in Orlando, came back, was home for a week, and then left for another week to go on a cool trip that we're going to talk about. And now I'm home again, did some coaching, and obviously we have the WM Phoenix Open in town this week. So a lot of people in town. We also have the Super Bowl in town here in Phoenix. So it's we are in full swing here down in the Southwest with two of probably the biggest sporting events in the world. I know the Phoenix Open is perennially one of the most attended sporting events in the world. And obviously then you've got the Super Bowl. So there's a lot of people in town. There's a lot of things going on, and it's just a fun time to be down here in Phoenix for sure.
Yeah, I remember that, man. I lived there for 3 years, as you know, and it was a really cool time. You know, in addition to that, you have obviously great weather, peak season, spring training. A ton of people are in town, and so it's really fun. And the golf courses are in great shape, and everybody's busy. So it's always a good time at this time of the year. You've had a crazy busy, 2 weeks, and just kind of listening and watching you on social media. I mean, you've had some exciting things happen. Obviously, we were at the summit a couple of weeks ago, and you were notified by Golf Digest that you were named Best Young Teacher in America, which is really cool. You went home and you actually got to play the stadium course at TPC Scottsdale and hit a hole in one, man. That thing was pretty cool and went viral. Tell us about that.
Yeah. We kind of touched on it on the last episode, but we didn't actually get into it. I came right home from the Teaching and Coaching Summit. I think I coached maybe one day, and then I got invited by a really good friend of mine, Christian, to go play TPC Scottsdale 2 weeks before the event. So basically 1 week before they closed the course down to let it heal up for the tournament. And I was like, you know what? This is a pretty cool experience. I've never played a tour course right before the event when the rough is long and the greens are fast and everything's, about to be ready for the event, plus you throw in the fact that all the bleachers and the grandstands and the stadium around 16 is going to be fully up and ready to go. I think it would be a pretty cool opportunity and one that I didn't want to pass up. So I went and played, and we actually started on the back nine first. There was a little frost delay that morning. It's been a little cold in the mornings here in Phoenix, so it was a little frost delay. And we started on the back nine because the course wanted everybody to get through, 16 through 18. That's the stretch everybody really wants to play. And so we tee off. I was hitting the ball pretty good that day. I was driving it really well, and it was fun having a caddy, carrying the bag and just being able to walk. And that was a fun experience. And then, we're coming up on 15, talking to the caddies. I was like, hey, you guys ever seen a hole in one on 16? You ever been in a group? They said, no, we haven't. We've seen some people get pretty close. A couple guys lipped out. One guy stopped about 2 inches from the hole, but we've never seen one. And so we roll in there. Really cool experience. You walk through the tunnel. They have TVs on both sides of the tunnel for general public, playing highlight moments just on loop. And, you emerge from the tunnel and you see the grandstands, and then you look, and obviously you've got the hole to your left. And obviously everybody says it, but it's just a pretty straightforward par three. They had us playing it from 131 yards, which is one of the yardages that they play it from in the event. I think Sam Ryder's hole in one last year was like 127 yards. So we get up there. My buddy Taiwan Walker hits first. He hits a good shot, a little left of the green, just trickles off. The other guy we were playing with, Stefan, hits, and I think he hit the green, and then I was third. So I stepped up. We had the cameras rolling because it would have been a cool moment just to play the hole either way. And I was nervous, man. You're just in the environment. You see the bleachers. You kind of know what that hole represents. And I just made a swing with a pitching wedge. I hit a pretty good shot. Obviously, it was a little draw, kind of going right at it. And everybody in the group, you can see it in the video, starts kind of getting excited because it's going right at the hole. And it takes one hop about, shoot, maybe 15 feet short of the hole. And then it just disappeared into the cup. So it just one hop and then disappeared. And that's why we were all in the video. We're all kind of stunned because it was a back hole location. So in the back of your mind, you're thinking maybe it one hop and disappeared over the back edge. And, you know, did it really go in the hole or did it just go long? And then there's this guy back there doing some work on one of the bleachers. And he came around from one of the corners. You couldn't see him when we were hitting. And he showed up around one of the corners and threw his hands up because he saw the ball go in. And that's when we all knew it went in. And it was surreal, man. It just like kind of hit me all at once. You know, to make a hole in one is obviously epic, but then to do it at that hole with the bleachers up right before the event, you know, I think we were talking and I was talking to some other people. There's probably like five places in the world I'd want to get a hole in one that everybody knows about. It's pretty memorable. And that's definitely in the top five. I think it's maybe Sawgrass 17, you know, 12 at Augusta, 7 at Pebble, 17 at or 16 at Cypress, and, you know, probably one other spot. Maybe I'm sure people would think of one other spot, but yeah, 16 at a TPC Scottsdale is pretty epic.
Yeah, dude, that was awesome. And the way you filmed it and, you know, obviously, you know, Golf Digest and the PGA and everybody wants to share that. It was a pretty cool deal. And to know, you know, I heard people, you know, Pat was talking about it and I said, that was Keith, man. And for him to recognize that, it was awesome, you know? Yeah. And it's cool listening to the story because, you know, you said something that I think is really important that we should touch on is on 15, you're walking and playing that hole and you were telling the caddies about it. You know, you basically spoke it into existence.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that's so important is to, you know, just put out into the universe what you want to get back. And it won't always happen, obviously, but, you know, we have to give ourselves permission to have those types of moments.
1,000%. And, you know, I started working with kind of like a mentor business coach bi-weekly and just talking about life and business and, you know, how to do better at what I'm already doing from somebody who's already been successful. And we actually had an entire hour long chat about the build up to that moment, the teaching and coaching summit, you know, the fact that typically I would have said like, no, I'm too busy to go play. Thank you so much for asking me. But I said yes to that. I knew it would be fun and I followed my gut, followed my instinct. And typically I would have found a way to say no, because I, you know, other things going on or busy or lessons or whatever. But you know, he really wanted me to stop and remember that the universe sort of rewarded me for, you know, following my gut and saying yes to that sort of thing, to what I typically would have said no to. You know, because I get asked to do a lot of cool things all the time, just very fortunate to be in a good industry and kind of well known on social media. And I say no to a lot of things. And, you know, he wanted me to embrace the build up to that, what it meant, and then, you know, to recognize those types of things going forward. So it was just a cool sort of coming together of a lot of things. And then, yeah, it's still pretty surreal. And people bring it up to me all the time. And obviously it's cool to have that moment.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you know, it's something that we were kind of talking about in Orlando is, you know, we don't have to try to force things or, you know, force results on or off the golf course. We don't need to force relationships, you know, just be who we are and allow those experiences and individuals to come to us. And going along that topic, some, you know, speaking things into existence, you've talked about wanting to maybe coach a tour player at some point, both of us have, and how much that might change a person's career. But, you know, in reality, those types of things involve so much luck and so many circumstances have to align themselves. But
yep.
Not very long after that, you had the call from a longtime student in Macklemore to ask you if you wanted to attend the Pebble Beach AT&T Pro-Am with him. I'm assuming you were there as a coach and then you ended up caddying, but I guess tell us a little bit about your background and relationship with him and how it's evolved over the years. And then we'll kind of dive into what that experience was like.
Yeah, you know, I met Ben Haggerty, AKA, everyone knows him as Macklemore, but you know, I call him Ben. I know I met Ben probably beginning of 2020, maybe like tail end of 2019, but beginning of 2020 for sure. You know, right when everything shut down for COVID and golf was the only thing we were allowed to play. And, you know, it's just sort of one of those things where he posted, I followed him on Instagram. He posted a video of himself making like an air swing, you know, a swing without a club at an airport, and he put it on his story. And I just wrote, you know, need more hip turn, you know, with a little thumbs up. And he ended up messaging me back, asking me about it. We had a little back and forth. He came back from touring. He was in Europe at the time. He came back from touring. We met up, we played a round of golf. I had a good round of golf. I think I shot like 66 that day, which probably helped solidify in his mind that I was, you know, knew what I was talking about, or could at least back up, you know, with playing what I knew what I was doing. And, you know, we kind of went our ways. We kept talking, and then we ended up getting together for another round of golf at Newcastle, where I was teaching at the time, and did a little range work after, and did some good stuff. And it just kind of, you know, long story long, it just kind of blossomed into a friendship with some coaching on the side. We kept playing a ton of golf together. We were playing a lot of golf together, probably 2020, 2021 there, really through, he was home for a long stretch, probably longer than he's ever been home for in the last 12 years, I'm guessing, or something, you know, whatever that time period is. And he was getting super into golf, and, you know, I was available, he was available. We were playing a lot, and a good friendship just blossomed. And he got invited to play to the AT&T Pro-Am as a celebrity. I think the first one he got invited to was 2020. And I was supposed to go with him then, but they had some restrictions in place as far as how many people each person could bring for, you know, the COVID social distancing, but all that sort of stuff. And then it didn't work the following year. You know, my son was born, a lot of stuff going on, obviously. And then this past year, it just kind of, or this past one, it just sort of worked out. And we talked about it. They got the okay from the tournament executives. And I went along, and yeah, I went as a coach slash caddy slash player support, whatever you want to call it. And it was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had. It was, you know, I had a credential that allowed me to go absolutely anywhere I wanted to, under, you know, in any area, under any ropes, inside the ropes. And it was just a total dream experience, dream week. One of the coolest places I've been on earth. Pebble Beach, Monterey Peninsula is like one of the most gorgeous places I've ever seen. And yeah, it was just surreal.
Really cool to hear that backstory. I you know, I was familiar with some of it, but not all of it. And something that you mentioned is kind of answers a question that I get asked a lot by our PGA students in the classroom is, you know, a lot of people want to coach high level players and maybe be on the tour someday, something along those lines. And at the end of the day, it just happens by chance to some degree. I think that, yep. You know, you definitely took your education seriously, and you built a incredible teaching and coaching business. You've done a lot of things that have been very important for the success of your career. And so you've worked very hard to get to where you are, but then it becomes a, you know, somewhat of a chance that you and he connected and ultimately developed a friendship. And I think you look at a tour coach and player relationship, and I think that there's going to be a lot of that. You know, these players are extremely good athletes, and at some point there's got to be this trust between the two, and encouragement and motivation, and a shoulder to lean on when a person's struggling, right? There's so many of these soft skills that are important that we sometimes forget about. And you mentioned being his friend and being there for support, but yet there was definitely some coaching and caddying going along during that event. Yeah. So It reminds me, a little bit about our relationship, the same way it started as, a teacher student thing, but it became a friendship. And over the years, we've become very close friends and we kind of mentor each of us, we take turns mentoring students. So I think that's quite similar to what we would see at some of those higher levels. Going inside the ropes though, and, actually working with him on his game. I'm curious to hear how that went, because you sent me some video early on in the week with a club face that was significantly open and he was struggling pretty badly with a high slice. And as the week progressed, his swing improved quite a bit to where at the end, I mean, those pitch shots that he was hitting was incredible. And it looked like, he had some pretty good short game shots in the competition. So tell us about that, how you arrived, where his game was, and how it progressed throughout the week.
Yeah, for sure. It in the grand scheme of things, it's probably like the least ideal situation, right? To work with a player to do some pretty significant things to a swing a day before he's meant to compete. Right. I mean, when you and I talk about that and we hear Butch Harmon and a lot of other coaches, right, everyone says, there's no coaching that's really being done the week of the tournament. If there is that, there's probably something that went wrong in the buildup or you didn't do your prep work enough. Every player's when they get to the tournament site is just trying to learn the golf course, get their feels, get their distances, learn the grass, learn the greens. There's very little probably technical skill work that's going on in reality. So this was kind of a unique situation where he was finishing his album. He was, he's got a huge clothing line that's really emerging. He's got a family, he's touring, he's press obligations. He's so busy. He hadn't really had a time to play or practice in the last 3 to 4 months, which is, obviously less than ideal. And he had sent me some video and I noticed some things, his grip had gotten a little weaker than it had been in the past. And his alignment and his shoulders and his hips and everything had gotten a little bit out of whack from where I had seen it when he was playing his best and hitting his best shots. And I noticed all that on camera, but sometimes it's hard to relay that, just sending text messages back and forth, which is kind of all we had at our disposal. So the good thing is I knew what I was going to do when we showed up, right? I knew right what I wanted to do. I wanted to get his grip back to where it was. I wanted to get his shoulders and his arms and everything aligned more so he could swing the club on a better plane. And, the first day didn't go that great, right? We'll be honest. He was getting pretty frustrated. I can't even imagine, to be honest, if I put myself in his shoes, right? The spotlight's on him. People are looking at him. Golf is something he picked up like 4 years ago. He didn't play as a kid growing up. Playing on national television in front of a crowd on some of the hardest golf courses in the world. And you show up and your game's rusty and you got to do the $1 million hole in one challenge. And, all these things, I can imagine the anxiety's just through the roof. And so a lot of my job was just to kind of be a voice, a calm voice, an encouraging voice, hey, let's just take this a little at a time. We don't need to fix this today. Let's just get you better each day. So by the end of the week, you're feeling more confident. And, we had some breakthroughs on that first day and got the club face a little bit in a better spot and got his pitching action starting to look a little bit better, started to get his setup where we wanted it to be. And, first day he got through the hole-in-one challenge, hit some good shots. And then by day two, by day three, he was hitting some shots that he was not capable of hitting on day one, which to me, that was probably the biggest success of the week is we were able to get him back to feeling more confident over what he was doing. Was it perfect? Absolutely not. We wouldn't expect it to be. And we discussed that and he was okay with that, obviously. But, I think the biggest thing is just, he was grateful that we, kind of saved the joy of golf for him, right? Like he said it to me that, golf wasn't even that fun right now because of how poorly he was playing. And just being able to hit some shots that he wanted to hit just brought the joy of the game back for him. And, that was a huge success in my mind. And I thought it was a successful week and an incredible learning experience for myself to step into that situation. I thought I handled it pretty well. I was calm. I was encouraging, right? I definitely was a little, you know, hard on him a few times when he wanted to revert back. I wouldn't let him, and he appreciated that. And I think we got him into a good place at the end of the week.
That's cool. That's interesting to hear it from your, you know, perspective, because I think so many of the listeners can actually relate to that. Whether it's a, you know, PGA Tour event that, right, you know, celebrity pro-am, or if it's just a Saturday game where a person is nervous and their game isn't where they want it to be. And there are some things that a person can work on. To you and I, his club face was obviously wide open. Obviously, to some players, though, that might not be as obvious. And so the most important thing that a player might do is to just learn what the club face should do during the golf swing. I think that you and I would both agree that we would want it to be square to the arc of the club head as it travels in a circle around us. So becoming aware of the path of the club, becoming aware of the club face as it relates to the path, could be very valuable for people to just understand what should happen and how it influences their golf swing. And then you kind of, you know, you drill down to what are those causes, what are the principles that are affecting those two laws of ball flight. And for you, it, you know, and your situation, you felt like it had to do with the setup. And so many golfers should be working on their setup. I mean, on a tour event, we see them with alignment sticks and different aids to help them get set up correctly. But on the amateur driving ranges, we don't ever see that. You know, it sounds like you worked with him on his grip, which has a direct influence on club face. You worked with him on his alignment, right? These are basics that a person can be practicing at home in front of their TV. I remember as a kid standing on the tile floor and using the floor, the parallel and the perpendicular lines to hone in on my setup. And these are still things that I practice today. I work on my grip every single time I hold a golf club. It's so important. And we can't take those things for granted. And so the way you just described that was so perfect, because anyone listening should be able to implement these things. And you made two comments about it, you know, being difficult. This was difficult, right? Changing a person's grip can be challenging, and it is frustrating. And here he is at a PGA Tour event, like you said, in front of millions of people. He's a mega celebrity. They're going to be paying attention to what he's doing. And he's frustrated as all hell, but he trusts you and the process and goes with you on it and actually sees some results, ultimately enjoying the game and that experience. You know, what a cool event and something that so many people can learn from.
Yeah. I did appreciate the fact that he did trust me and went on the journey with me. The interesting thing about being Ben and who he is there was probably 5 to 10 different people at all times come, you know, wanting to give him advice on his swing, right? Even when I was standing back there, you know, helping him. And he was talking about how people in the buildup were trying to help him with his swing. He went on a photo shoot with a tour pro for his brand, and that player was trying to help him. There were other people at the video shoot trying to help him. And, you know, he said something to me that was pretty cool. He said, you know, when you come around, the ball starts going in the air. And what that meant to me is that the information that I have for him resonates the most and is the most easy for him to digest. And it reaffirmed that how I teach and what I teach and how I go about delivering the information is simple, it's digestible, and it's easy for the person to learn regardless of the player, and especially in a high stress environment. I mean, I don't know that I'll be in a more, you know, demanding, stressful environment in the next year than that one right there. You know, and I, full transparency, I was nervous too, right? I was like, I've never done this. I was talking to you. I was like, you know, let's come up with a game plan. Let's figure out what I'm going to do. You know, I wanted to be successful. Obviously I wanted it to work. My name's attached to a lot of it, so there's that anxiety on my end, But once I got in the environment and once I kind of got doing my thing, it was become very simple. And I think the great thing about how we coach, talking about how to move the golf club and what the face should be doing, the arc of the swing, the path of the swing, it's universal to all players. You know, I didn't talk to him about his body other than his alignment. I didn't talk to him about his hips should move other than, you know, getting him more square to dress. I let him sort all of that out. And I think from what he was talking, a lot of people were trying to get him to move his body certain ways. And they were forgetting about talking to him about what the golf club needed to do to hit the shot that he wanted to hit. I mean, to you and I, it seems so obvious. Well, that ball's going 45 degrees to the right and it's taking off at a crazy high launch angle because your club face is 45 degrees open in the downswing. And the fact that nobody had brought that up to him other than myself was quite astounding for me. But it was almost like, oh man, this is too easy. Like, let's just get that face more square. The path, you're swinging the club on a good path. Let's get the face more square to the path. And that ball has to start going straight. It's not my opinion, it's physics. And so we started working on that. I obviously make everybody do smaller swings. I had him hit little chip shots 30 yards. You know, that's the first thing I had him do. I was like, dude, we're not doing this at a full swing yet. Let's get those chip shots going. Let's get the face square. Let's start getting some confidence. I put the ball on a tee for him for the first 15, 20 shots. I mean, I wanted to make it as easy as possible. I had to get his confidence back up. And then we could start rolling. And, you know, that's what I do for everybody. It doesn't matter for the player. I got to get some confidence. I got to get some trust. They got to see the ball. Once that player starts seeing the ball going straight, man, their buy-in is just through the roof. And it was the same with Ben.
Dude, you just nailed it. I mean, you touched on so many good things that anyone listening should rewind and listen to again, you know, from being club focused. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a stick and a ball sport. We have a paddle on the end of a long handle. That paddle just happens to have loft on it. We need to learn what that tool is supposed to do. Slow swings and small swings. I mean, we tend to want to fix things at full speed when we can't even do it correctly at a slow speed or a small swing. Those are imperative for improving our golf swing. And then ultimately building confidence. I mean, seeing success with some pitch shots is going to lead to us seeing success with some three-quarter swings. And then from there, we move into the full swing. So we have to take this incrementally. We've got to crawl before we can walk and walk before we can run. So the way you went about this whole thing was so textbook, and the way that a listener should implement this would be that they rewind this and they kind of go through exactly what we've talked about with the process to which you improved his swing. And then the way you went about it from a teacher's perspective, because they need to be able to understand it and implement it. So, you know, the way you did that was awesome. Congrats. That was really cool to hear. And I want to kind of shift gears to what your experience was like inside the ropes watching a tour event. You know, it wasn't just about the amateurs. You weren't there as a coach and a caddy. Heck, you were also watching as a spectator and watching the best players in the world. So you got to play 36 holes basically with two PGA Tour players, you know, winners on tour. So tell us what that was like. What were the takeaways and things that you saw most important among their skill set?
Do you want to work one-on-one with either Henry or Keith? Well, you're in luck. Both Henry and Keith offer online lessons and monthly coaching subscriptions using the Skillist app. Online coaching allows you to learn at your own pace by digesting smaller chunks of information more frequently. Download Skillist, search for Henry or Keith, and get started today.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience and one that I've been like dying to have and haven't been able to, you know, up until this point, which is just to walk around, be inside the ropes, observe, watch how the best players in the world handle different courses, different shots, different weather conditions, good shots, bad shots, you know, all that sort of stuff. And the coolest parts of the whole event too was just being inside the ropes at the driving range and just being able to look at what I wanted and you know, watch players hitting shots and listen to their coaches and caddies talking about certain things. And then of course, you know, in golf nerd, the golf geek inside of me, you know, golf lover, just was like in, that was like Candyland, Disney World for me. And then, you know, being able to go for a tour event was just next level. I mean, I was caddying right there. I was pulling flag sticks. You know, I was raking bunkers, getting the flag handed off to me by, you know, the other caddies. And it was just a cool experience. But yeah, so I played with Lonto Griffin, who was Ben's caddy or Ben's pro partner. And then Garrett Higo, who was Schoolboy Q's pro partner. And I came away from that event, man, just being incredibly impressed by the demeanor, by the emotional control, by the decision making, by the short games. Holy crap, we could talk about the short games for an episode. Just the calm, the poise, and the shot making from those guys. And I think Garrick was probably the most impressive. Garrick Higo is a 23-year-old South African lefty. I saw him miss two fairways in 36 holes, and they were very small misses. I mean, everything was just like a little 2-yard draw or like a 1-yard fade. He hit everything right where he was supposed to on the greens. He didn't get upset over a bad break. He on one of the first few holes we played there at Monterey Peninsula the second day, he hit a wedge right at the flag and hit the flag and came off the green some 40 yards. And I looked at him because I wanted to see how he would react. And you wouldn't know if he just dunked it or if he got a bet. I mean, there was no emotional reaction whatsoever. You know, he gave his caddy a little sideways look. They both kind of smirked, put the club in the bag, and then they walked up to their shot. He hit it to about 3 feet, and he made the putt, and he moved on to the next one. And that really stuck with me. And a few other things happened like that during the week where I see so many recreational players that I play in our little pro-ams. Every bad lie, every bad break, every mishit is like some sort of big demonstrative reaction from the player. And there's just no way you can keep your emotional control together when you're reacting like that. And these players just don't do that. They've probably all gotten to the point where they recognize how unproductive that is for them to play their best golf over an entire week span. It takes too much energy. It takes too much emotion. There's going to be so many more shots that need to be played that require their full attention. And for them to get up and down highs and lows like that, it makes absolutely no sense. And yeah, it was just an incredible experience. Their short games are just phenomenal. They missed in some bad spots a few times, but dude, they chipped it to stone dead from some just brutal spots that I was like, man, this is a 1 out of 50, and they knocked it up there tight and rolled in the putt. And it was just really cool to see. Really, really cool to see.
That's awesome. Couple of things really stand out. Number one, obviously the short game, and you told me about that, and I think you're right. Maybe that's a topic for another day because we can dive in pretty deep with how that looked and how a person might implement some of those things. But, you know, just real briefly, I want to hear a little bit more about that mental and emotional maturity, because I work with a lot of young players and, you know, we have highs and lows and sometimes some broken clubs or some thrown clubs. And you know, you mentioned that bad break, which could send even an experienced player off the rails. You know, myself, you know, I feel like I'm up and down quite a bit, and there's a lot of stress and anxiety going on in around the golf. And, you know, I can just imagine a tour playing being so level-headed and mature. You know, I don't know if a person's using sports psychologists. I don't know if a person is, you know, evolving through the various levels of competitive play through elite level junior golf to college and then the pros. If someone's taking them under their wing and mentoring them, but I'm just kind of curious to hear your thoughts on that and how a player might transition from this emotional roller coaster that we go on to something that's more level headed and mature and taking things one shot at a time.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important topic. And keep in mind, I'm seeing a 36-hole sample size. I don't know what these guys were like when they were 14, 15-year-old as junior, right? From all accounts, you know, Roger Federer was a hothead who would break tennis rackets when he was a junior, right? And he admitted to that. And now when you see Roger Federer play tennis, and he's retired now, but when you see him play tennis, he was as cool as they come. He never reacted to any bad break or any good shot. A little fist pump if he could hit a good one, but would never react. And, you know, he talked about learning the value of keeping your emotions more flatlined and how it doesn't help a player to get up and down because there's so much more coming as far as the shots they have to hit next. And whether or not Garrick had to learn that more kind of stoic, level-headed mindset, or if he's just always been that way, I think it's incredibly impressive to see it so level-headed as a 23-year-old. As you alluded to, there's a lot of young college players out there who are 23 years old, 22 years old, who are much less level-headed. And you just see, you know, there's probably a lot of college players out there who hit the ball as good as Garrick, but maybe they don't have the emotional maturity that he does at 23 years old to be out on tour and to travel and to get the bad breaks and the good breaks and to stay calm. You know, I watching him, you could tell he was going to have a good week. And I think he finished top 10. When you watched him go about his business, you're like, this guy's going to contend this week. I just had a feeling. And sure enough, he was there, you know, towards the end of the week in the top 10. But for me, it was just one of those things. At some point, you know, obviously I've read a bunch of golf psychology books, Bob Rotella, you know, Fred Shoemaker, the list goes on, where they just talk about how it's just so unproductive to get high and low like that and to ride that emotional roller coaster. But as a player, it's all well and good to hear that from someone. I think you have to go through it enough, realize that it does more detriment to your game than it does good. And finally just say, okay, I'm done reacting in this, you know, big fashion to everything that happens to me on the course. And it takes some discipline because it's a skill that has to be trained, just like putting and hitting the center of the putter face. There's going to be times on the golf course where you react, and that's okay, as long as you recognize that that's the action that you want to stop taking. And you have that little moment of mental clarity and going, okay, I did it again, but let's not do it anymore. And that's kind of the first step to being able to harness your emotions, you know, for a more productive game of golf.
Yeah, for him to be 23 is obviously, you know, he's mature for sure. He's a PGA Tour player, but he's still quite young. And, you know, to see that level of maturity is impressive. And, you know, working with players that are his age or a little bit younger shows that we really need to prioritize that emotional side of the game. And you're right, there's lots of books out there that could be read. And at the end of the day, we need to be able to just recognize how that behavior that we have, the emotional highs and lows, might be detrimental to our game and make it a priority to change that. You know, that when we start feeling hot-headed, maybe to use that as a red flag to have some way of resetting and refocusing. I think that would be another area that we can discuss in more detail, because that is so important. And you saw it firsthand inside the ropes at one of the biggest tournaments in the world. So it's cool to hear that perspective. I think the listeners have two valuable things that they can take away from this episode. First is the way a player arrives at an event or at a weekly money game and their game isn't quite prepared and they are feeling nervous and frustrated. And yet there are some simple things that a person could and should be working on throughout the weeks, throughout the year, to work on their skill set with regard to ball flight. And then the other is the mental and emotional side of the game, which is less quantifiable and more challenging to understand because there's nothing tangible about it. At the end of the day, though, I think it just comes to prioritizing it and seeking out that information and finding individuals who have a little bit more experience and can help guide us through that journey. But those are the two big takeaways for me, and I hope that our listeners can grasp that. It's been a fantastic chat, and I think that we have a few things that we can kind of parlay into multiple episodes moving forward. But Keith, I want to thank you for a good episode and a great chat on some of the things that have been going on in your life. And I hope you have a great day and the rest of your week. And if there's anything else you'd like to add, I'd be happy to hear it.
Yeah, no, I think this was fantastic. You know, thanks to everybody for making the last few weeks happen. It's been, you know, definitely a highlight of my golfing my golfing journey so far, and got some other cool things, exciting, you know, to line up here in 2023 that we'll definitely talk about in future episodes. And yeah, just very grateful, and enjoyed the chat as always, man. So we'll be back next week. And if anybody has any questions for us or topics they'd like us to discuss, reach out to us at any point on our Instagram pages. We're always happy to chat.
Good stuff, Keith. Take care, buddy. Have a good day. Have a great week. And we'll be in touch soon.
All right, buddy.
Do you want to work one-on-one with either Henry or Keith? Well, you're in luck. Both Henry and Keith offer online lessons and monthly coaching subscriptions using the Skillist app. Online coaching allows you to learn at your own pace by digesting smaller chunks of information more frequently. Download Skillist, search for Henry or Keith, and get started today.